Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Tonight, follow along as we unravel the haunting tale of the Weepy Voice Killer, a figure whose crime struck the fear in the hearts of the people in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Join me as we dig deep in the mystery behind the tears, the terror, and the twisted mind of a killer who left a trail of tragedy in his wake, one call at a time. It's time to start the show. Let's hit it. Welcome, and thank you for joining me for another episode of Mysteries, Mayhem, and Merlot. I am your host, Winnie Schrader. We are going to encounter a very bizarre and twisted serial killer, one that couldn't even stomach the own guilt of his murders he had just committed, so much so that he called the police on himself so they could stop him from killing more. Within January of 1981 and August of 1982, Minnesotans were ensnarled in this web of fear and dread as Paul Michael Stefani emerged as this nefarious serial killer of the Midwest. His moniker, the Weepy Voice Killer, Stefani left this indelible mark on our criminal history here in Minnesota, not merely for the brutality of his heinous acts, but the 911 calls he left behind to confess what he'd just done. It was through these emotional, sorrow-laden phone calls, a twisted ritual of sorts, that Stefani communicated directly with police and further intertwining his evil needs. Okay. It was through these emotional, sorrow-laden phone calls, a twisted ritual of sorts, that Stefani communicated directly with police, further intertwining his evil needs with a surreal and unsettling vulnerability. Now, Karen Potak was a young 20-year-old college student that was attending the University of Wisconsin. She was in St. Paul December 31st, 1980, attending a New Year's party with her sisters and some friends. Anywhere between midnight and 1 a.m., Karen's group got ready to leave, and when they noticed she was nowhere to be found, unbeknownst to them, Karen decided to walk the short distance back home. She took the route near Pierce Butler Road and Syndicate Avenue in St. Paul, where she was ambushed by an attacker. She was bludgeoned over 10 times with a tire iron, stripped, and left for dead. Around 3 a.m., January 1st, 1981, a call came in to 911.
Yes, please, this is an emergency. Please send a squad to Pierce Butler Road, Molenberg Manufacturing Company, machine shop. Please, there's an ambulance too. There's a girl hurt there.
Can you tell me what happened to her?
Just hurry. She's laying on the ground in the back by the railroad tracks, by the edge here.
What's the address?
I don't know.
Who are you?
Oh my gosh, that was unnerving. Well, Karen miraculously survives the brutal attack on her by Paul Stefani, but it left her with severe brain damage and long-lasting health issues. With the damage that she sustained during the attack, it left her with no memory of it or who attacked her. So some time has passed now since Karen Potack was brutally beaten and left for dead. And all was quiet until June 3, 1981. Kimberly Compton was a 18-year-old small-town girl from Pepin, Wisconsin, and as she stepped off the bus, she was excited to get to her plans to start her new life here in Minnesota, but first, food. She walked across the street to the now famous Mickey's Diner in downtown St. Paul. There she sat down alone in a quiet diner to have a meal and to start planning what she could explore in the new city. Just a few booths down from hers, though, sat Paul Stefani. He noticed that she was alone, so he walked over to her and introduced herself. They began to chit-chat about her and how she was new to the area. That's when Paul offered to show her around St. Paul, witnesses said. They got up after their meal and left. That was the last time Kimberly Compton was seen alive. 8 hours later.
Will you find me? Somebody with a knife pick. I can't stop myself. I can't. Somebody with a knife.
Now, at first they thought it was a prank call, but one thing that stood out that was mentioned was ice pick. That information was not public at the time, so only the killer would know that information. Kimberly Compton was found face down near a road construction site near the Mississippi River just south of St. Paul. Reports say that Paul took her up to the secluded area to show her a good view of the city and lured her out of the car to take a look. That's when he brutally attacked her with an ice pick, injuring her 61 times. When the police arrived at the scene, they could not find anything to identify her or other than a key they found in her pocket. It belonged to the bus depot that was across the street from Mickey's Diner. They found the locker that the key belonged to and proceeded to open the locker. There they had found her belongings in the locker and now they had a name to a face. When the autopsy was performed, they found undigested food in her stomach, which is now putting some puzzle pieces together for the homicide detectives on the case. They could trace Kimberly from the bus station across the street to Mickey's Diner, so they immediately went to the diner to interview the staff that was working when Kimberly was there. None of them could come forward with anything that would help the case move forward. Another roadblock, and now the case has stalled again. Until. On July 21, 1982, Kathleen's friend Carol Kellogg drove to Kathleen's house in Roseville, Minnesota. It's just a little suburb just outside of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Well, Carol was picking up Kathleen so they could take their trip to Mackinac Island in Michigan. Carol knocked on Kathleen's door multiple times, no answer. So Carol let herself in to find Kathleen. She began calling out for Kathleen, still no answer back. Carol began searching room to room when she found Kathleen face up in the bathtub as if she were taking a bath. Her death at that time was ruled an accidental death. Paul did not make a call after Kathleen's murder, but there's more to that a little later. Now, Paul's next victim, Barbara Simmons, she was a 40-year-old woman, a nurse in Minneapolis, and she wanted to have a night out with her friends. So on August 6, 1982, she went to the Hexagon Bar in Minneapolis. She was having a great time, and she met what she thought was a nice man at the bar that night. They hung out most of the night, and when she was ready to leave, she said to the waitress that was serving her that night, "He's cute. I hope he's nice since he's giving me a ride home." Barbara's body was found the next day with multiple fatal wounds. And then another call came in.
"Don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry what I did to Compton. I couldn't help it. Don't know why I had to. I am so upset about it. I keep getting drunk every night. I can't believe it. It's like big dream. I can't think of being locked up. If I get locked up, I'd kill myself. I'd rather kill myself than get locked up. I'll try not to kill anybody else."
"Fire emergency.
Please don't talk. Just listen. I'm sorry. I killed her. I shot her 40 times. Kimberly Compton was the first one. Oh, my safe. Oh, I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm sick. I'm going to.
Whoa. That makes the hair on my arm stand up. That's creepy. What would cause a human being to be like this? Well, here's a little backstory on Paul. Paul was born September 8, 1944 in Austin, Minnesota. Well, the only thing really known in Austin, Minnesota is Paul Stefani and, yes, the Spam Museum. Paul was raised in a strict Catholic home where he was the last of 10 children before his parents divorced. Paul's mother remarried when he was just 3 years old. Allegedly, Stefani's stepfather was very physically abusive to him and his siblings and would often hit the children, sometimes even knocking them down the stairs. According to the Star Tribune, Stefani moved to St. Paul in the mid-1960s and began working as a shipping clerk and janitor. He was briefly married and even had a daughter, but eventually divorced and his wife and child left him behind. It was around then that his violent impulses really began to materialize. Stefani was, by appearance, a devout Catholic, but under the surface, a dark and disturbing thoughts plagued him all the time. Later, he would claim that before every assault he committed, he would hear voices urging him to attack. And while it was reported that the voices in his head that drove him to kill, his religious guilt may have driven him to call the police to report his crimes amid tears. So it kind of seems like he's using 911 as a confessional booth and purging his sins of murder. So how did Paul Stefani finally get caught? On August 21st, 1982, Stefani picked up a prostitute named Denise Williams in Minneapolis. Once she got in his car, she knew something was off with him, and he proceeded to drive to a dark suburban area where he attacked Denise with a screwdriver 15 times. Denise managed to get away by breaking a glass bottle over Stefani's head and causing cuts to both his face and head. She began screaming, which caught the attention of a man that didn't live too far away. The man ran over and began wrestling with Stefani, causing Stefani to flee the scene. But at least Denise got an ambulance called for her so she could get to the hospital so they can address her wounds. Now, when Stefani reached his apartment, he realized how bad his wounds were, so he sought medical help and called the local hospital. The nurse that took the call recognized his voice. She jumped up and screamed, "That's the same voice that's been on the news about the weird phone calls 911!" which led the police right to Stefani's front door. Denise Williams also later identified him as her attacker as well. Now, during the trial of the Simmons case, they had Stefani's ex-wife and a woman that lived with him for some time testify that the voice on the 911 calls was Stefani's voice. Stefani was found guilty of the murder of Barbara Simmons and the attempted murder on Denise Williams. He was sentenced to 40 years in prison. In 1997, Stefani was diagnosed with skin cancer and had less than a year to live. Being the staunch Catholic that he was, he came clean and confessed to the murders of Kimberly Compton in 1981.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. That, wow, how have I been living like this feeling? It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Wow, how have I been affording this? It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. The quality that I've received from Mint Mobile is second to none, and I've tried them all. And this is an amazing company to work with that actually cares about their clients and the prices that they charge. So if you're on that fence wondering, should I make the shift? You're going to get great coverage, you're going to get great customer service, and all of the bells and whistles you expect from the bigger brand names. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans and their jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/P60. That's mintmobile.com/P60. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/P60. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to just $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Drowning Kathleen Greening in 1982. Remember earlier when they deemed her death as an accidental death? Not anymore. Now the truth is out on what happened to Kathleen Greening 15 years prior. And the murder of Barbara Simmons and the attempted murder on Denise Williams, both in 1982. On June 12, 1998, at age 53, Paul Stefani passed away from skin cancer at the Oak Park Heights prison in Oak Park Heights, Minnesota. The weepy voice killer reminds me of the intricacies of the human mind and the chilling depths of desperation it can go to. His crimes are a stark reminder of the darkness that can reside in us. And it also serves as a testament of the perseverance of law enforcement and the resilience of communities in the face of fear. Reflect on this unsettling chapter in our history. May we continue to seek understanding, empathy, and justice for those affected. Now it's time for your crime beat of the week. First up, Harvey Weinstein. Weinstein was sent to the hospital prison ward after a New York rape conviction overturned. Former Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein was taken to prison and inside Bellevue Hospital in New York on Saturday for testing, days after the appeals court in the city overturned his 2020 rape conviction. On Saturday, Weinstein's publicist and his lawyer both confirmed that Weinstein, 72, was transferred from Rikers Island jail complex to the Manhattan Hospital. Weinstein had been in custody at the regional medical unit that was part of the correctional facility in upstate New York. When he was transferred to New York City, they said that he triggered some health issues that warranted some close monitoring, the publicist added. That's why he was transferred to Bellevue. Frank Dyer, a spokesman for the New York City Department of Corrections, also confirmed Weinstein remains in custody at Bellevue Hospital. Weinstein, who has faced health problems over the years, has been serving a 23-year sentence at a correctional facility in upstate New York and was transferred to a medical ward at Rikers following Thursday's appeals court decision. Weinstein was hospitalized in early 2020 for heart and blood pressure issues around the time of his sentencing in New York. Weinstein is due to be in Manhattan Supreme Court on Wednesday. Weinstein was originally sentenced to 23 years in prison in a New York trial. He was convicted of forcefully performing oral acts on a former production assistant at his apartment in 2006, and of the rape in the third degree for an attack on an aspiring actress, Jessica Mann, at a hotel in 2013. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office has pledged to do everything in their power to retry this case. Even after all the appeals and the court ruling, Weinstein is expected to remain in prison because he also faces a 16-year sentence on a separate case in California, where he was convicted in 2022 of rape, forced oral copulation, and sexual misconduct. The New York reversal of 4-3 decision nevertheless outraged sexual violence survivors and advocates judges who dissented in the appeals court decision. Guess who's made a weekly appearance in the news? Boeing! Yes, Boeing is back in the news, and not for good reasons, of course. The Delta Airlines flight that departed from JFK International Airport in New York was forced to make an emergency return to the airport Friday morning after an emergency slide came apart from the Boeing 767, the airline said. A search for the slide was ongoing. After the aircraft had safely landed and proceeded to the gate, it was observed that the emergency slide had separated from the aircraft, a Delta spokesperson said in a statement to the NPR Friday afternoon. In a statement to the FAA, said Delta Flight 520 returned safely to JFK International Airport in New York around 8:35 a.m. local time on Friday, April 26. After the crew reported a vibration, the FAA will investigate. The Delta spokesperson said that the airline is fully supporting retrieval efforts and will fully cooperate in the investigations. In an earlier statement, Delta said the flight crew had observed a flight deck indication related to the right wing emergency exit slide, as well as a sound from the right wing. The plane that was delivered to Delta in 1990 was on its way to Los Angeles International Airport, but had to return to JFK about an hour into the flight, according to the flight tracking site. A passenger who was aboard the flight did not wish to be identified, and for good reason, while still in transit, told NPR that there was a very loud sound coming from the plane, which made it difficult to hear the announcements coming from the cockpit. Passenger told NPR they felt very overwhelmed and really scared by the experience, as nothing more is important than the safety of our customers and people. Delta flight crews enacted their extensive training and followed procedures to return to JFK, said a Delta spokesperson on the initial statement to NPR. The airline said that the flight crew declared an emergency with air traffic control to receive clearance to return to JFK. The aircraft then landed safely and proceeded to the gate under its own power, it said. Delta told NPR that there will be no pressurization issues on the aircraft. It said that the plane has been removed from service and will be thoroughly evaluated. An aircraft is generally operable for an average of 30 years before it's decommissioned, according to Flexport, a global logistics workflow company. The aircraft involved in Friday's incident is around 34 years old, and its expiration date was previously May 2028, according to the FAA. We will defer to Delta for comment, a Boeing spokesperson said. Well, of course they did. In June of last year, the same flight, Flight 520 from JFK to LAX on a Boeing 767, was forced to make an emergency landing in Utah following an onboard technical difficulties. Oh, Boeing, get it together, will ya? Now, this next story is one of those stories that goes down that slippery slope, my friends. An athletic director used AI to frame principal with racist remarks in a fake audio clip, police say. Well, this story is so convoluted, I'm just going to play the news clip.
You may remember the clip, it was allegedly, of the Pikesville High School principal making racist and anti-Semitic comments. After a month-long investigation, police have arrested the school's athletic director for allegedly fabricating the audio clip using artificial intelligence.
It's the story everyone is talking about today, as Jessica Albert has been on it from the very beginning and joins us now live on your corner in Towson with these new details tonight. Jessica, good evening.
Good evening, Rick. Baltimore County Police say that this case is a bizarre case of retaliation. They say that the school's principal had started investigating the athletic director for misappropriating funds shortly before this audio recording was released. An audio recording containing racist and anti-Semitic comments allegedly made by Pikesville High School principal Eric Eiswirt has been proven to be fake, Baltimore County Police say. Police have now charged the school's athletic director, 31-year-old Dazon Darian, for allegedly making the recording using AI.
We are grateful that we can bring some sense of closure to the community and that we can now shift our focus to moving forward and providing all parties with a fresh start.
Police, school, and county leaders held a news conference about the arrest. Charging documents reveal police believe Darian made the recording after Eiswirt opened an investigation into Darian for misappropriating funds, allegedly making unauthorized payments to other staff at the school. Darian was taken into custody Thursday morning at the airport while trying to get on a flight to Houston. They say he had a gun with him at the time, but cannot say whether they believe he was trying to flee.
Darian was stopped due to the method in which his declared firearm was packaged. When officers looked into his background, they learned he had an open arrest warrant.
The recording first popped up on social media on January 17th. Eiswirt was removed from the school pending the investigation. According to charging documents, detectives traced the recording back to Darian through the email it was sent from, and that Darian allegedly searched OpenAI tools on a school computer. During the investigation, Eiswirt told police he never said the statements on the recording, and he believed Darian may have made it because of the investigation against him. The documents also alleged the recording was sent to other teachers, one of which allegedly sent the recording to media outlets, the NAACP, and to a student who they believed would spread it rapidly. Police are investigating whether those teachers will face charges.
Those are the things that AI should not be used for. It is scary to know that somebody could take your voice and make you say whatever they want you to say. Now we have software that can detect that AI software used in a digital recording like they did here in Baltimore. But it's still a scary notion because once it's out there, it's out there. Now here's a cool news story. Person fishing with a magnet pulls up a rifle other than new evidence in a 2015 killing of a Georgia couple, investigators say. Someone using a magnet to fish for metal objects in a Georgia creek pulled up a rifle as well as some lost belongings of a couple found slain in the same area more than 9 years ago, officials said. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation said the driver's licenses, credit cards, and other items dragged from the Horse Creek in rural Telfair County are new evidence in a murder case that is still awaiting trial. A citizen who was magnet fishing in the creek on April 4th discovered a .22 caliber rifle, the GBI said in the news release Monday. The unnamed person returned to the same spot 2 days later and made another find, a bag containing a cell phone, a pair of driver's license, and credit cards. The agency said the licenses and credit cards belonged to Bud and June Runyon. The couple was robbed and fatally shot before their bodies were discovered off a county road in January 2015. Investigators say at the time that their bodies and the couple's car were found in three different locations, CBS affiliate WMAZ-TV reported. A few days later, investigators arrested Ronnie Adrian J. Towns on charges of armed robbery and murder. They said Towns lured the couple to Telfair County by replying to an online ad that the 69-year-old Bud Runyon had posted seeking a classic car, though Towns didn't own such a vehicle. Georgia courts threw out Towns' first indictment over problems with how the grand jury was selected, a prolonged legal battle that concluded in 2019. The delay started because fewer than 16 people reported to jury duty out of the 50 summoned when prosecutors originally took it to the grand jury. Towns was indicted for the second time in the killings in 2020, and the case was delayed again by COVID-19 pandemic. He has pleaded not guilty. Court proceedings have also likely slowed by the prosecution's decision to seek the death penalty, which requires extra pretrial legal steps. And last but not least for our crime beat of the week, Oklahoma fisherman believed friend was going to sacrifice him to Bigfoot. Larry Sanders, not this Larry Sanders. This Larry Sanders was convicted of first-degree murder and faces life in prison without parole. A fisherman admitted to killing his buddy because he planned to feed him to Bigfoot after summoning the mythical creature, according to Oklahoma prosecutors. Larry Sanders was fishing with a friend, Jimmy Knighton, in the South Canadian River in Pontotomac County, Oklahoma, when Sanders suddenly strangled Knighton after claiming to see Sasquatch-looking creatures down the stream. So in his statement was that Mr. Knighton had summoned Bigfoot to come kill him, and that's why he had to kill Knighton, Sheriff John Christian told NBC affiliate KTEN after the July 2022 murder. Nearly 2 years later, a judge convicted Sanders of murder. Yes, there was a monster in the woods that night, but it wasn't Bigfoot, it was Larry Sanders, Pontotomac County District Attorney Eric Johnson said. Now, back on July 9, 2022, Sanders and Knighton were noodling, a method of fishing where a person is submerged in water and uses their bare hands to snatch catfish by shoving their arms in the fish's mouth. Catfish typically live in holes along riverbanks, and the controversial practice is popular in the South. During their expedition, Sanders claimed that he saw three Sasquatch-looking figures by the river and believed Knighton was going to kill Sanders and send his body down the river as a snack for the Bigfoot creatures. Yeah, can you please pass the Larry? Sanders waived a jury trial and claimed he acted in self-defense. His fate was determined by a judge during last week's trial, where the judge listened to testimony from a forensic psychiatrist who said Sanders suffered from a meth-induced psychosis. That's when Sanders wrapped Knighton in a deadly chokehold. Law enforcement found Knighton's body the next day. Knighton's son, Arian, who was dating Sanders' daughter at the time, said during the trial that Larry was talking fast and frantic. I asked him, "Where's my dad?" And he said, "He's not coming back," Arian Knighton testified. Sanders' daughter, who had a strained relationship with her father at the time, said he confessed to killing Knighton at least five times. Sanders was ultimately convicted and faces life in prison without parole. Thank you for listening to Mysteries Mayhem at Merlot. And until our next case, my armchair detectives, stay safe, stay vigilant, and stay aware. I'll see you next week right here on Mysteries Mayhem at Merlot on the Paranormal 60 Network.